What we're looking at here is Britain's Challenger 2 tank. It was the very first Western tank to be donated to Ukraine, and it is known as probably the best protected tank in the world. The UK gave 14 of these to the Ukrainians, and in 18 months, only one of them has been destroyed, at least as far as we know. This is an historic piece of footage, because until now, no Challenger 2 had ever been lost to enemy forces in combat. So, how did this happen? We're going to examine the tape, analyze the Challenger, then get hands-on with the tank and speak to a commander to find out. This is the wreck of a Challenger 2 near the town of Robotnia, filmed by troops of Ukraine's 82nd Brigade during last summer's counterattack. One clip shows the tank not long after it was blown up, and the other shows the same tank a few days later. These clips may be short, but if we slow them down, then there's actually quite a few clues we can pick up about what happened here. First, we can see what looks like a large blast hole right behind the tank, here and here. If we look at this clip, we can see there's maybe some damage down here at the front, but the turret and the rest of the hull are otherwise intact. However, there's what looks like blast damage back here, and something has fallen off here. Here, the tank is on fire. There's flames coming out the back and smoke out the front, but despite the damage, you can just about see its tracks are intact. So what does that all tell us? Let's look at how a Challenger is put together to figure that out. The Challenger 2 was designed to do two things: keep the crew alive at all costs, and kill other tanks. That's where its first party trick comes in. It has maybe the best armor on the planet, Dorchester, a variant of the Chobon armor that is used on American Abrams tanks. Dorchester is a composite, meaning it's made up of layers of different materials, exactly which is a secret, but we think a mixture of steel, ceramics, and elastics. This is designed to shatter or deflect incoming shells, and is how the Challenger got a reputation for being unkillable. Because the Challenger was designed as a tank hunter, this armor is concentrated on the front of the turret and the hull, where it is most likely to be shot by other tanks. It has one known weak spot right here, a part called the glacis. The British have made an extra armor panel to bolt over this spot, but the tanks given to Ukraine don't have it. All that armor makes the Challenger very heavy. The basic model weighs over 70 tons, and with the extra panels, this can push north of 80 tons. It's powered by a V12 diesel engine, which is mounted round the back. This is less powerful than the engines in the Abrams or German Leopard tanks, making it less nimble. Its top speed is just under 40 miles an hour, compared to 45 miles an hour for the Abrams. It drinks less fuel, however, and has a range of up to 340 miles, with spare fuel stored in these tanks just in case. Inside there are four men: the commander, gunner and loader, all of whom sit in the turret, and the driver, who is down here at the front. Unusually for Western tanks, the Challenger's ammo is stored in two parts: the ready rack back here for the projectile tips, and the charge bins down here for the explosive charges. These are combined in the gun just before it fires. The charge bins are armoured to stop white-hot shrapnel setting the explosives alight, known as a cook-off, if the tank is hit in battle. Because of where the engine, fuel and explosives are positioned, the rear of the Challenger is another weak spot. This area can also be protected with extra armor, but again, it appears the tanks Britain gave to Ukraine don't have it. If we go back to the tapes, we can see these weak spots are exactly where the Russians targeted. Here at the front, the glacis looks like it may have suffered some damage, while at the back, you can see the fire is concentrated around the engine compartment and the fuel canisters, and just a few feet away is that blast crater. Based on all of that, here's how we think Russia destroyed this tank. The Russians likely laid a line of anti-tank mines across this road. They have millions of these things, and they use them a lot, sometimes stacking them two or three high to make them harder to disarm and more destructive when they go off. Whilst driving towards Russian lines, the Challenger probably hit one of these mines, causing that blast crater. This likely disabled the tank, called an M-kill or mobility kill. This means the tank cannot move, but can probably be repaired if it is rescued. In order to stop it being rescued, the Russians probably hit the tank with another explosive, either an anti-tank missile or a drone. Their goal was to set light to the fuel or ammo, causing the tank to burn, turning the M-kill into a catastrophic kill, or K-kill, and putting the tank out of action for good. In this case, it looks as if the fuel set alight, knocking one of the spare fuel drums off. At this point, the crew would have been forced to bail out and leave the tank to its fate. Despite the damage, we think all four crew made it out of this tank alive, which is a testament to how well protected the Challenger is. Until this moment, the only Challenger that had been destroyed in battle ever was killed by friendly fire from another Challenger, which actually isn't all that surprising when you learn about this tank's other party trick. What makes the Challenger a true tank killer is its main gun. This is the L30A1, one of the most accurate cannons fitted to any Western battle tank. What makes it so accurate are these spiral grooves cut into the barrel. This is called rifling, and it is designed to make the shell spin as it is fired. The spin stabilizes the shell in the air, meaning it can fly further and still hit targets accurately. Couple that with gunner and commander sights that are also stabilized and can lock onto targets, have night vision and laser rangefinders, and you've got a very precise weapon. In fact, the gun is so accurate, the Ukrainians refer to it as a sniper. The rifling also means the tanks can use a special type of shell called HESH, or High Explosive Squash Head, which is like a giant wad of plastic explosives. When it hits its target, it squashes up against it, conforming to its shape, before a fuse detonates the explosive, causing a huge amount of damage. This is not just effective against tanks, but also against concrete bunkers and other fortifications. American and German tanks both have smoothbore cannons, meaning the inside of the tube is smooth, which makes them less accurate. And these generally use high explosive anti-tank or heat rounds rather than HESH, which are great for killing tanks, but not so great on fortifications. All of this makes the Challenger an excellent tank, but perhaps not the best tank for Ukraine. This war doesn't play to the Challenger's strengths. As we've seen, it is a tank hunter par excellence, but tank-on-tank combat has been pretty rare. That's because tanks are in short supply for the Ukrainians. Even with all the tanks donated by the West and the ones Ukraine has captured from Russia, it has a little over 1,000 of them left. The UK gave just 14 Challengers and has been pretty clear it is not handing over any more in a hurry. Meanwhile, the Russians, even after all the losses they've taken, have roughly 2,000 tanks on the front line and are producing around 125 new ones each month. For that reason, Ukraine doesn't want to risk the few tanks it does have in direct combat where they might be destroyed. It mostly keeps them behind the front lines, using them to bombard Russian defenses or thwart infantry attack. Rarely, it sends them to attack Russian trenches, and only a couple of times have we seen them fight Russian tanks head on. This is partly a fault of the Western tanks. Russia, with its huge army, designed its tanks to be cheap and easy to make. They're not the best, but there are a lot of them. The West, meanwhile, designed bespoke machines that are very effective, but expensive and difficult to make, meaning not as many of them exist. A single Challenger 2 costs more than $5 million, and the UK, in total, has made a little over 200 of them. It plans to upgrade around 150 of those to Challenger 3 in the near future, but it is not currently building any new ones from scratch. This didn't matter for wars like those in the Middle East, where the Challenger 1 fought and was hugely effective, but it does during big, intense wars like the one in Ukraine. Now, here's what all of that looks like in real life. This is the Royal Tank Regiment, putting the Challenger 2 through its paces. We can't tell you exactly where this happened or show you inside the tank, but they let us get up close and into the tank to learn what makes it so hard to destroy.
We're here at an undisclosed military base in the south of England to get hands-on with a Challenger 2 tank.
Here's that Dorchester armour I talked about earlier, protecting the front of the turret. Here's the main cannon coming to bear. And you can see the rifling on the inside of the barrel just here. Here's what the V12 engine sounds like up close. From this distance, we can see a few extra features as well. These are the smoke screens. They work by spraying a jet of neat diesel fuel onto the burning hot exhaust manifold, which vaporizes into a dense smoke that shields the tank from enemy fire. Up here is the commander's sight, and just below that is the gunner's sight. These are the smoke canisters. They fire out of the tank, explode, and dazzle enemy heat-seeking rounds. Around the top of the commander's hatch, you can see a ring of periscopes, which allows the commander to see out of the tank if his sight gets hit in battle. Just to the side of the main cannon here is a little opening that contains a manual sight in case all the digital sights get blown up or shot away. And inside the little bump on the end of the gun here is a mirror. The gunner uses this in combination with a light to make sure the cannon stays properly aligned, increasing its accuracy. Down here, you can see where the driver sits and his periscope. And just through this hatch is the boiling vessel, or BV. This allows the Brits to make tea without getting out of the tank and is jokingly referred to as their most important piece of kit. What's it like inside the tank?
For security reasons, we can't show you the inside of the Challenger 2 tank, but I managed to get inside. What can I tell you about what it's like in there? Well, it's cramped. The commander is sitting on top of the gunner. The operator is hard up against the other side of the cannon. You can see notes that have been scribbled on the inside of the turret as they're shouted through the communication system. I imagine in a combat situation, it's a very intense place to be. But if I had to go into combat, I can think of few places I would rather be than inside the best protected tank in the world.
We spoke to Sergeant Major Shannon Wood to learn even more.
When you're rolling into a firefight, because as you've seen in there, there is a lot of radios, and the Challenger 2 has a complex radio system. So it has pretty much, every tank is basically a command variant. So you'll have your headset on, and when you've got your headset on, so is your other crew members. Each crew member will have intercom, so we can all talk to each other through live IC. So the commander will be telling the gunner to do things, the commander will be telling the driver to do things, the driver will be asking questions. The operator's probably just singing a song, you know, if he's not loading. But then, on top of that, he's got his squadron net coming through his right ear, or his left ear, depending on how you've got it selected. And you know, you've got your officer commanding, saying, right, I want this troop to do this, what have you seen? Tell me what that, you're reporting up enemy you've destroyed, reporting up obstacles you may have seen. And then on the other side of your ear, you've got the battle group net. So you've got the battle group commander, so the commanding officer, colonel, giving you directions on this one. So it can get very, very confusing, very claustrophobic. And you know, unlike most vehicles, when you're navigating, and I know everyone has sat navs and they have Google Maps now, but we don't have that in the tank. We have a combat system, but you're not just going to go down the track, you know, in 400 meters you're going to find a right turn, because why would you? You want to go cross country, and for some reason we never seem to operate east to west or north to south. It's more, you know, southwest and stuff. So if you imagine you're going cross country and you're trying to stay balanced in like a mechanically formed movement for best practice, but you're facing your turrets, your hull's facing one way and your turret is facing the other way, and it's at night and this is going in your ear, it can become, you know, very stressful, but it's pretty cool.
What's it like inside when the tank is opening fire?
Yeah, there's no better smell than the cord, I tell you. You get used to that. But no, it's not loud at all. So, you know, before you fire, you must get the vehicle into overpressure. So basically, it's just pushing all of the air outside. So imagine when you go underwater and it goes quiet and everything's silent and peaceful. That's what it feels like with the headsets on, because the headsets are noise cancellation headsets. So you can just hear each other talking. You know, the tank's firing, you know, on the outside, it's smashing windows. It's setting car alarms off. But inside, it's not like that at all.
Shannon deployed to Iraq. I wanted to know what that was like.
I joined the army in 2006, and by 2007, I was in Optelic 10 in Iraq. I was there as a spare crewman, so when soldiers were going on R&R, I would then get into the gunner seat. But the most of the time in Iraq, I was dismounted. I was on Mastiff, sometimes in Warrior, and sometimes in Merlin, getting dropped off for VCPs. But what I can tell you is that it was extremely hot, you know, 40 plus degrees. It does have an air cooling system in there, CTCS, but that's only gonna get you so far. There is no windows. And as you've probably been in the vehicle already, it looks like a big vehicle as you can see it, but actually when you get inside, it ain't very big at all. And you know, some people see that as a con, but the way I look at it, the smaller it is inside, is only gonna tell you that there's more armor on the outside. So lucky for me, I was fortunate not to be in combat in the Challenger 2 tank, but I've watched it come in as my friends have climbed out after they've been IED'd. And basically, how they describe these IEDs. And these IEDs are taking out, you know, civilian vehicles, they're taking out other armored vehicles. But they say all it sounds is like someone's throwing a stone on the vehicle. We'd then pull back into camp, and then it would have to maybe replace the barrel because it's had some fragment damage, some of the armor's been damaged. We've had tanks come back in with RPGs hanging out of the bar armor. So overall, extremely survivable.
He also helped train the Ukrainians to use this tank. So what were they like?
They weren't nervous. They were extremely excited. You know, if you know that you're going to go to war and you get to pick a vehicle to go to war in, surely your top of your choice is going to be, you know, a heavy armored vehicle from the British, which has some of the best armor in the world. So straight away they're excited. Obviously they're not too excited because they're at war. In regards to like their eagerness to learn, you know, I've trained recruits, I've trained troop leaders, I've trained potential gunnery instructors, you know, schools instructors, and that's just a course, you know, and like you'll take any job or any day-to-day course, you'll treat it as such. But when your life's on the line, your spider senses, you know, come to the end, and you seem to learn a lot quicker and a lot faster. And actually at the end of the lesson, if that's a Friday, and you say, any questions? Normally, you're not going to get questions from us, are you? Because you want to get home on the weekend. Yeah. But for them, the questions will continue and continue and continue. We've trained people on the Challenger 2 who don't speak English before, you know, your Kuwaitis, you know, the Omanis are getting trained by the British when we have people over in Oman on the Challenger 2. So that's not, that's never been an issue. But the issue was, you know, the amount of time we got given to train them. My main role was to, once they've been done the gunnery side of life, once they've done the D&M side of life, once they've done the communication side of life, once they've done the tactic side of life, and then they were given the tanks, it was mine and a small team's job to observe anything they've missed and help them put it all together on the real thing, unaccompanied by any instructors.
The Ukrainians had just 5 weeks to learn all of that. How long does it take to train a Brit?
So if you're teaching a British commander, that British commander's already been a gunner. He's already been a driver. He's already been a loader. So he's already got the experience of bits and bobs. We were training people just to do the one thing and the one thing only. But actually, that wasn't the fact at all. The pace they learnt at, and you know, yes, the days were elongated and the weekends were taken away, but it was ample time for them to be able to operate the vehicles successfully and to a great standard. You go to Bovington and you do a 6-week driver's course. You then come to your regiment, you'll then do your driving duties. So you'll go on exercise, you'll go on ranges, you may go on operations. While you're doing that, you're watching your gunner, you're listening to your commander's word of command. You're kind of picking things up, you know, subconsciously. And then once you've reached the stage of your driving, you go and do your gunner's course, which is another 6 weeks. You'll start doing that, you'll then come back to unit, you'll go into ranges again, you do the exercises, potential operations, and then you've got to do your operator's course, which is 2 weeks of loading. And you know, you're not just loading the weapon system, you're check navving, you're working the radio systems, you're ensuring the crew are fed because that's where the boiling vessel is. You're selecting the right ammunition for the select tangent elevation. And again, you're learning and learning. And once you've done all those places, you are personally selected by the commanding officer and the career management officer on who is going to be the right person to be on a Challenger 2. Then you get sent away on your tank commander's course. And on your tank commander's course, you revisit all of those, but in a more technical state. And then you put through an arduous course of just like night navs, day navs, tactics over and over again, which is not a pass, 100% pass course. There is a pass or fail. So there's a lot of experience and it takes a lot of times to be on the main battle tank, but that's the nice to have. You know, if the British Army was told, actually, you've only got this amount of time to do it, we could probably also do it ourselves, but there is no need to rush for us as there was for them.
Now the big question. What makes the Challenger so hard to destroy?
Good. It's the crewmen, mainly, but obviously most tanks, as you know, work off the triangle, mobility, survivability, and lethality. And I think the Challenger 2 hits all of those in spades, especially the survivability. So it's 120mm, like most main battle tanks in the world, rifled cannon. So most barrels are still smoothbore, are now smoothbore. We stayed with rifled. This will give us a little bit more accuracy and allows us to use something called a HESH round, a high explosive squash head, which can reach up to 5,000 metres. Unlike other weapon systems, it's a three-part ammunition. So you have the projectile, you have the propellant charge, what goes behind it, and then you have the initiator. The reason for the three-piece ammunition will allow you to store more armament rounds in the vehicle than those with smoothbore. For example, the Challenger 2 has 49. So the HESH round is loaded, the charge is loaded, and then the initiator is automatically loaded into the weapon system. Once it's fired, the projectile will go down the barrel, begin to spin, which will give us its accuracy, When the bullet hits the target, on impact, it will squish and then detonate into highest explosive fragmentations. Yes, so as you're looking at it now, that is some of the best armor in the world, but just to give it an extra top up, we can add additional armor. Obviously that armor is secret, but that'll bolt on, like you'll see most main battle tanks in the world start growing in size as the armor is fitted.
Mm. And what will that stop?
Pretty much anything.
That's where this tape stops, but we'll be back soon to play you through another episode of War on Tape. Hey everyone, thanks for watching. If you want more videos like this in your feed, don't forget to hit like and subscribe to our YouTube channel.